Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Corporate profits on the program today, the good, the bad, and the ugly. Big time money and big time politics. And another installment of our series, Your Economy. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Tuesday, today the 27th of January. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. As we get going, three big names in American industry and what they might have in common. DuPont is one. Procter & Gamble is another. Pfizer, the drug company, is a third. We could, and yes, I know this is a fourth, but we could throw Caterpillar in there as well. They all reported profits today, all falling short of analysts' best guesses, which is a bad thing, and all of them pointing the finger at the foreign exchange markets. From New York, Marketplace's Stan Alcorn gets us going now with more on the downside of a strong dollar.
The reason for the spike in the dollar is good news. Sameer Samana, global strategist at Wells Fargo, says it's because foreigners want a piece of the American economy.
That's exactly it. So basically, people want to own U.S. assets.
More demand for U.S. assets means more demand for U.S. dollars, something that happens when the U.S. is doing really well or when the rest of the world is in crisis.
I think that's what's surprising people. You know, you're not in a financial crisis, and yet the dollar is doing so well.
The dollar's surprising strength is a weakness for American exporters. It makes their goods more expensive to sell abroad. But something different happens to multinational corporations. They suffer from something that Stephen Englander, a foreign exchange strategist at Citigroup, calls the translation effect.
This translation effect, which most of these companies seem to be pointing to, actually doesn't affect U.S. activity.
Englander says it doesn't affect U.S. activity because it's all about those companies' overseas businesses. Think of a company that owns a business in Europe that has European suppliers and European customers. The strong dollar doesn't impact any aspect of that business until the parent company brings the profits back to the U.S., and some of those profits are lost in translation. Mauro Guillen is a professor of international management at Wharton.
So when they repatriate those profits and turn them into dollars, whatever money they made in euros or they made in yens or they made in any other currency is now worth less in U.S. dollars.
Guillen says that may hurt a company's stock price, but it won't have much of an impact on the broader U.S. economy.
An investor based in the United States who is invested in an index such as the Dow Jones will feel a relatively small effect.
Guillen says the bigger effect of a strong dollar is a positive one. It makes it cheaper to buy everything from Saudi oil to French wine. In New York, I'm Stan Alcorn for Marketplace.
Not all earnings today were dismal. We should say that two, in fact, stand out. Yahoo CEO Marissa Mayer announced after the bell that she is going to spin off the rest of her company's shares in Alibaba, the Chinese e-commerce behemoth you may have heard about. It's a $40 billion transaction to the benefit of Yahoo shareholders. Also, Apple. Oh, my goodness, Apple. Earnings, needless to say, were quite spiffy. As just one example, the company sold 74.5 million iPhones last quarter, which means when you add it all up, the iPhone alone on a quarterly basis is a bigger business than Microsoft and Google combined. Think about that. All right, moving on. As parts of the Northeast dig out from the snow today, and yes, it is still snowing in a whole lot of places, but no small number of people will be doing that digging out in between emails and online presentations and conference calls. It is, of course, telecommuting, which means productivity losses are expected to be relatively small as a result of the blizzard of 15. Nova Sappho did his part for us from his apartment in New York.
Here's a glimpse into my head when I realized we'd all be staying put in our homes as a massive snowstorm was projected to roll through New York. Well, as it turns out, that Paramount film, aptly titled Snow Day from the year 2000, is pretty outdated by now. A lot of us spent the storm working from home.
I'm right now actually sitting in a tracksuit in my office at home.
Nicholas Bloom is actually in sunny California, lucky. He studies telecommuting at Stanford and says it's been growing at the low and upper ends of the income ladder.
And the low-paid jobs tend to be telesales, IT servicing work. At the top end, it tends to be managers, professionals, that also work from home. And strangely enough, there's not that much in middle income.
Bloom says snow days are a good example of how telecommuting has taken hold, for some workers at least. And it's not just in business. Eric Gunderson is the superintendent of the Pascack Valley Regional High School District, about 15 miles from New York City.
There was a biology teacher who was going to have some students presenting their research project to him via Skype.
Other teachers had assignments today, too. Gunderson started experimenting with so-called virtual snow days last year.
Are you the Grinch who stole snow days?
Well, some would argue that it's the downfall of snow days.
So no more lazy days drinking hot chocolate or making snowmen. Still, Gunderson quickly adds that most kids would rather lose a snow day than make up a day of school during spring break. Well played, sir. From my apartment in New York, I'm Novosafo for Marketplace.
I don't actually know about that snow day and kids thing, but, you know, maybe that's just me. Anyway, about Wall Street today, I will say only this. It could have been worse, snow and all. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Remember all the talk in 2012, the last presidential election cycle, about how that was going to be the campaign where outside interest groups would spend $1 billion? Yeah, welcome to the new normal, everybody. Conservative electoral financiers Charles and David Koch made some campaign finance news yesterday. They said their organization, all by its lonesome, will spend $889 million ahead of Election Day 2016. That would be, should it come to pass, more than twice as much as the Republican National Committee spent in 2012. Marketplace's David Gura is on the line with more on this story from Washington. Hey, David.
Hey, Kai.
All right, let's get the basics first. Where is this money, all of it, going to come from, and where is it going to go?
Well, to your first question, we don't know. I mean, that's sort of how these outside groups work. So we can say broadly it's from a lot of wealthy donors, and they'd gathered this weekend outside Palm Springs at the Ritz outside Palm Springs at a seminar, as it's called, that the Koch brothers convened. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about a few hundred people here who have committed to give money to this organization, to this network ahead of the campaign. And to your second question, where is it going to go? Some of it's going to go towards ads. That's probably a sure thing. But this is a big organization, and it's gotten bigger. It's a very complex network. Mm-hmm. The Koch brothers have invested a lot of money in data gathering and data processing, in technology, in the ground game. We saw some of that in the midterms that just passed a couple of months ago. Yeah. So, you know, it's going to go to a lot of different things, but we are talking here about a really huge sum of money.
You mentioned the midterms. They were, you know, what, three-ish something months ago, and were already back in the money chase. I guess it probably never ended, did it, right?
Yeah, and I should point out the Koch network spent about $290 million on the midterms, so they were invested in that as well. I mean, you and I have talked about a perpetual campaign before, and folks I've talked to said there were just no breaks anymore, that after a midterm you might have been able to sort of cool your jets until the following summer, and that's just not the case anymore. And if anything, naming a figure like this, setting a figure like this, is just going to turn up the heat on both Republicans and Democrats, on people on both sides of the aisle to have to raise more money.
Right. Well, along those lines, and you and I have talked about this, you've done a bunch of reporting on this, what we have now is private money being raised by a private organization, right? What does it say about, I guess you could say, the fate or the state of the national political parties, the Democrats and Republicans?
No, I think they've both got to be worried, because you've got these outside groups who are setting the message, they're controlling the message to an extent, and I think even more fundamentally, they're doing things that parties used to do or that they have been doing. I mentioned the ground game and collecting data. That was the providence of parties for a really long time. And a political scientist I spoke to said it's really difficult. It's becoming increasingly difficult for parties to make long-term investments in infrastructure, the mechanisms that let them collect that kind of data. So when you look at that, and you look at the even colder calculus here of talent and who's going where, there's going to be the attraction to work for a candidate or work on a campaign. But increasingly, these outside groups are doing more, and I think often they're paying more, so they're going to start drawing talent to them that would have gone to parties in the past.
Yeah. One last thing before I let you go, and it's going to sound kind of random, but I'm oh so curious. $889 million, not $890 million or $900 million or $880 million. Why the specificity, if you will?
Your guess could be as good as mine here, but I did talk to one professor who said he thinks it's because you're dealing with a group of people, these wealthy donors, who like a budget. Perhaps they've advanced how much they'd be willing to spend ahead of this next campaign. And there's something to that specificity. And in my reporting, I was looking at the notion of political spending as an investment.
Right.
And when you have wealthy donors like this, they're used to assessing or getting a return on that investment. And at this retreat in California, a number of these donors got to meet with some of the candidates who were elected thanks in part to money that the Koch Network donated to push for them to win those races. So that budgeting is one part of it.
And they like to count their money, too. That's the deal, right?
There you go.
Arguably the first salvo in the campaign finance wars of 2016. David Gura on the story for us in Washington. Thank you, David.
Thanks, Kai.
All right, quick. What is the most disliked part of your job? Is it long hours? Ungrateful bosses, perhaps? Sheer drudgery, maybe? How about that very special time of year known as annual performance reviews? That's the winner right there, right? But get this. As much as you, okay, we don't like them, it turns out some human resource experts and professionals aren't so crazy about them either. Marketplace's Annie Baxter looks at a movement to ditch the dreaded review.
Rob Polakowski has endured dozens of year-end performance reviews. One of his worst experiences came about when he was working as an IT manager. Polakowski says his employer had given him glowing reviews for nearly a decade. Then the company got bought out by another firm.
Somebody came in and they said, you know, you're really not living up to the company's expectations. And I said, wait a minute, that's news to me. I've got 10 years of stellar recommendations and evaluations behind me. Everybody says I've done a great job. And they said, no, I'm sorry, you haven't. By the way, you need to leave. How long will it take you to get your stuff?
The Society for Human Resource Management says about 90% of companies do performance appraisals at some point in the year. But only a small share of HR types give their appraisal process high marks. Management expert Sam Culber at the University of California, Los Angeles is also critical.
The metrics are baloney. One manager's team player is another manager's conflict avoider. There's no consistency.
Culbert's the author of the book, Get Rid of the Performance Review, How Companies Can Stop Intimidating, Start Managing, and Focus on the Results That Really Matter. Culbert says the annual review took off in the post-war era as companies tried out new management techniques. And then he says in the 80s, a chief executive at General Electric, Jack Welch, popularized a way of ranking workers as a part of performance management.
So you could give 20% excellent, and then you had to give 10% either improve or get fired. And the rest of the 70% were some form of average.
Experts say the performance review can turn adversarial when talk of rankings and raises gets mixed into a conversation about an employee's growth and development. And if the conversation only happens once a year, that creates all the more pressure. A few big companies like Microsoft and Kelly Services have acknowledged flaws in the traditional appraisal process and have retooled big chunks of it. Ditto for software giant Adobe.
For too long, we've appeared as the police people, if you will, the regulators of processes that weren't necessarily valued by the intended audiences, whether it be by managers and or employees.
Donna Morris is Senior Vice President of People and Places at Adobe, which has 12,000 employees worldwide. A few years ago, Adobe spiked the traditional annual review. Managers and workers now do regular verbal check-ins every couple months. There's no paperwork. Employees get clarity on their goals and can ask for support in getting their jobs done.
People just really want to have an ongoing dialogue. They want to know that there's no surprise in terms of how they're performing, how they can make a difference in the organization.
But Adobe's system may not put to rest the fear of getting fired that many workers associate with performance conversations. While Adobe is retaining more of its top workers under its new approach, it's also letting go of the weaker employees at a faster rate. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
Coming up,
I have made a conscious decision to not let my fear dictate how I'm going to live my financial life.
Our series, Your Economy. But first, let's do the numbers. I was expecting the Wawa's. Truly was. The Dow Industrial's off 291 points today, 1 2/3%, 17,387. The NASDAQ dropped 90 points, 1.9%, closed at 4,681. The S&P 500 fell 27 points, 1 1/3%, ended things at 2,029. Come on, raise your hands if you thought it would have been the Wawa's. Procter & Gamble rolled down 3 4/10% today. The strong dollar, as we said, bit into its second quarter earnings. Software giant Microsoft clicked down 9 1/4% today. It, too, warned the strong dollar will cut revenue by 4% in this quarter. However, and oh, by the way, the company also took a hit from weak PC sales in China and Japan. Bond prices fell just a tad. Yield on the 10-year T-note stayed at 1.82%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, a House Veterans Affairs subcommittee holds a hearing on examining the quality and cost of VA health care. Facebook posts a status update. It is scheduled to release quarterly earnings. And 100 years ago, President Woodrow Wilson signed an act creating the U.S. Coast Guard. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Nowhere is the truism, you gotta read the fine print, more true than in the land of economic statistics. Case in point, this morning's report on orders for durable goods. Down was the word from the Commerce Department, off almost 3.5% in December from a month earlier. But you do a little nipping here, a little tucking there, adjusting the way economists like to do, and what's called core durable goods was off just 0.6%. Tim Fitzsimmons has the whys and wherefores of how we got that number.
Durable goods is an index that means more or less what you'd think. Stuff that you buy but don't immediately eat or throw away. Technically, it's stuff made here that should last at least 3 years. Dale Jorgensen, a professor of economics at Harvard, says making this index starts at the Census Bureau, which calls up big companies like Boeing, Caterpillar, and GE.
So they collect information on what the shipments were, what they actually shipped out to their customers, what they're holding in terms of inventories, and then finally what they received in terms of new orders.
And then from that, further indices are drawn out. Some of these are the ones economists like to watch because they leave out industries that spend huge amounts very suddenly, says Steve Landefeld, visiting professor of economics at the U.S. Naval Academy.
People like to separate out defense goods because they are quite lumpy. They are very large, and they can cause the numbers to be distorted if you're trying to look at the underlying trend in the private economy.
Chris Varveris is Senior Managing Director at Macroeconomic Advisors. He says the index is really a measure of American industry, not consumption.
So the lags in recognizing changes in underlying demand and the lags in wrapping up production can lead to a bit of extra volatility in the manufacture of durable goods compared to, say, consumer spending on services.
Varveris also says that there's an upside to this index. Manufacturing only accounts for about 15% of jobs in the U.S., so it's not as immediately connected to the fortune of the everyman. But this morning's drop worried investors because it's part of a trend that started last fall. In Washington, I'm Tim Fitzsimmons for Marketplace.
Fact is, you got to have a good digital strategy these days. You have to find a way to find customers online. But trying to keep up with all the latest best practices can be daunting. There is the sheer volume of options to start with, and the fact that all of those digital options and strategies seem to change by the day. A lot of companies hire consultants to help them navigate things, but there is another option, Google. Yeah, no, not Googling digital strategies, thank you very much. Get strategies from Google, the company, at least as it applies to Google products like YouTube. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson visited Google's brand new Brand Lab in New York.
A bunch of Lancôme executives are sitting around a table, pressing cardboard goggles to their faces, craning their heads left and right, and generally having their minds blown.
What? We've just flown across the world.
Not literally. They're demoing a new Google offering, a cheap virtual reality headset.
This is so cool.
How would you move to another room? Would you literally?
It's part of a workshop in Google's new Brand Lab space in New York. It looks a bit like a cave surrounded by video sound stages. The point of Brand Lab is to teach companies to do digital better. The Google team spent more than a month preparing for this one-day workshop, creating a custom curriculum for Lancôme, and they've done it all for free. But when it comes to creating a digital strategy, it's not as though Lancôme is starting from scratch.
Here, I'm going to use Lancôme's new color design 5-pan palette.
The company was one of the first to partner with a YouTube star. Michelle Phan has a huge following for her makeup tutorials.
This Sienna Sultry palette usually goes best for work because of the earth tone colors.
Now, lots of companies are turning to social media power users to help them pitch their products. And so Lancôme is wondering,
what's next? What are we going to do differently tomorrow? Because Michelle Phan was years ago already.
Xavier Vey, president of Lancôme US, says the company wants to be chic and French, oui, but also more accessible.
What is the new luxury? Before, it was just about scarcity. It was just about being inaccessible.
They want their customers to share and build on the company's video and other digital content. They want to target millennials without alienating the rest of their customers. And Google wants to help Lancôme do all that for free. Well, free-ish. Kim Larson is the global director of Brand Lab.
It's free because this is, we get a lot out of it. There's a huge amount of relationship building that we want to do. We want to invest in our top brands. We think it's that important.
They've partnered with cable channels who want help launching a new series and a beer maker looking to promote its Super Bowl ads online. And just like Lancôme is trying to figure out what next, so is Google. Brand Lab is supposed to help them answer some questions of their own.
How are companies thinking about digital? How are their strategies shaking out? And what kind of insights and opportunities are there? So how can we develop products and better tools to help service their needs?
Google opened two new Brand Lab offices last year, including one in New York to be near Madison Avenue advertisers and the country's biggest brands. Scott Galloway is a marketing professor at the NYU Stern School of Business. He thinks these corporate tutorials can also help Google answer another question. How can its divisions, like YouTube, make more money?
As dominant a platform as YouTube is, it's under-monetized. And at some point tomorrow needs to be today. It needs to be a more meaningful part of the revenue stream. Google is still largely a totally search-driven company from a revenue standpoint.
Meaning they still derive much of their income from the ads that appear alongside search results. Google wants Brand Lab to help them diversify. And Galloway thinks it might work.
Advertising, even in a digital age, is largely relationship-driven.
So not only is Brand Lab helping companies create better videos and stories, which might draw more eyeballs to YouTube, Galloway also thinks the more comfortable a company like Lancôme is with Google's products, the more likely it might be to spend money on them down the road. In New York, I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
For a beast the size that it is, $17 trillion or so, the American economy is a remarkably personal thing. And although we do spend some time on this broadcast talking about various and sundry indicators and statistics like today, the economy is really only as good or as bad as we think it is, as we feel it to be. So for the past couple of months, that's the question we've been asking. How does your economy feel? Today, Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and listener Michael Strain.
My economy, it's always wondering, when is the other shoe going to drop? My partner and I have very comfortable jobs. We both make enough to get by. With that said, I'm always wondering when something's going to happen that's going to potentially take it all away from me. As a social worker, I've seen all these people go through these struggles. What would happen if, say, one of us were unemployed or if one of us got sick? One slip and you could lose it all. It's almost pathological with me. I'm always looking at the numbers. I'd be embarrassed to say that I have a giant spreadsheet with all my financial life just spread out in front of me. And it's almost daily that I'm looking at it, seeing, where can I earn more money? Where can I save more money? How can I pay something off faster? I do believe that the economy is getting better. My friends, my colleagues, they're starting to buy homes, settling into their jobs for the long haul. I'm starting to see wedding bells of a number of them, actually. With all that said, I don't want to put my faith in that just because that's unpredictable. The only thing I can control is the money in my own pocket.
I keep a firm eye on the past, but at the same time, I take a step back and ask, okay, have I not seen this before? And have we not recovered from that before? I am not going to let my fear decide how I am going to live my life.
Now's your chance. Your thoughts on your economy. Send them to us at marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out today, in which maybe, just maybe, two things are going on. The first is that the long slide in oil and gas prices might be coming to an end. According to AAA, today is the first time in 4 months that the price of a gallon of gas was more expensive than it was the day before. Granted, it's not much, $2.38 today a gallon versus $2.33 on Monday. So that's one thing that's happening. The other, which is entirely possible, I don't know, is that I'm reading too much into statistics like we were talking about earlier. All right, we got to go. The Dow off 291 points today. Wawa trombones notwithstanding. That's 1 2/3%. The NASDAQ off 90 points, 1.9%. The S&P 500 fell 27 points, 1 1/3%. Caitlin Esch and Millie Jefferson are the producers on our Marketplace desks. Our digital producers are Raghu Manavalan and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.